the fact that you were so good at so many things and like could have gone into any number of things, I feel like both of us probably could have gone into any number of things and been pretty successful if we were passionate about it.
Yeah.
But for me, like, I don't know. Once I discovered theater and that was something that I was actually good at and maybe better than you at.
Definitely.
I was oh, maybe I've found it. And like,
I got my thing.
Yeah, exactly.
Connecting the dots with the Renaissance people.
The world seemed to conspire to delay the release of this podcast episode, but I said no. Oh, no, no, no. It is happening. And so 24 hours later than I really wanted it to come out, here it comes. This episode is with my little baby. Okay, he's not a baby. My little brother, Brian Skellinger. It was so exciting to have him on the show, and I can't wait for you to hear our conversation. Here's a few of the things that we talked about. First, Brian's rejection, of course, like he would, of my potential terms for his identity and why he feels like a survivalist, which he has his own definition of it. You'll hear that. I also talked about how these conversations that I've been having on this show are actually helping me adjust my definition of what a Renaissance person is and the Renaissance mindset. I embarrass my little brother, like I do. We talk about living in the shadow of a Renaissance person, older sibling, and how he found theater. The impact of our parents' careers on our mindset, the power of improv, how we reject hyper-specialization, the toolkit of skills we bring with us throughout our careers, how in the arts, connecting the dots means being empathetic, and how we're both drawn to fellow Renaissance people. And really fun, we get into Brian's thought process in creating the Connecting the Dots with the Renaissance People theme song. So here we go.
And we're live. Brian Skellinger, you're here.
Hello.
Hello, hello.
I'm here.
Applause dies down slowly. Welcome to Connecting the Dots with the Renaissance People. And I'm going to dig right in to a super juicy question at the very forefront. So if Brian's voice sounds at all familiar to listeners, it's because he is the voice of the theme song of my podcast. And so I wanted to have him on to talk about that. So that'll be kind of like a departure from my usual things. But I also wanted to bring Brian on because I personally think of him as a Renaissance person. And he's also the best person I know at pushing back on my ideas when he disagrees with them. He will not hold back.
I have to.
He will call me out. You're my little brother.
That's right.
It's what your job is. So I know that if I say something and he's like, yeah, not really, he's going to say it. He's going to call me on it and it's going to be great. So you may call me on this first question.
Okay.
And you have full permission to do it. And it's about identity.
Yeah.
So I gave you a little list ahead of time. We'll see which one you pick. I'm very intrigued.
Okay.
Which term best aligns with your identity? Renaissance person, multi-passionate, generalist, versatilist, Jack Jill, Jay of all trades, boundary spanner, or something else?
Well, of course, I couldn't pick anything that you picked for me.
Oh. Of course not. Big sister can't tell you what to do.
No, I have to be an original.
That's right.
I don't know. When I think about all of those things, I sort of have like very specific ideas about what those mean.
Mm-hmm.
And I just don't know if any of them necessarily apply to like how I view myself, at least. Maybe other people like you would say that I am a Renaissance person or something. But I picked a word and then I like looked it up and it has a completely different meaning. So I'm changing the meaning of this word.
Do it.
Like, beware, Webster. Dictionary, like you're getting a new entry.
He's in a fighting mood.
Exactly. So when I think of like Jack of all trades and Renaissance people, I sort of think about like the passion behind it.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of my skills are in things that I wouldn't necessarily say I am passionate about pursuing, but I've just developed as a skill to just make me more marketable and as just like something to do. Because, you know, I started out as an actor professionally. And I think a lot of my passions and interests are in the arts, whether that's acting or singing or improv. And so it doesn't feel as like versatile,
mm-hmm.
I think, as what I would consider like a jack of all trades. When we think of like a trade being more of like a job sort of thing, or when I think of a jack of all trades, it's like this person who can like come over and like fix the pipes under your sink and then like teach you how to do ballroom dancing.
Yes.
And, you know, like, it just feels like a wider variety.
Mm-hmm.
And mine are all sort of, like, specifically within the arts. So in terms of, like, my other things that I've done job-wise, I came up with Survivalist. And now Survivalist has sort of a doomsday prepper.
I was going to say, are you in the bunker with the cans and the water?
I'm not hoarding food and resources. I'm not in a bunker in the middle of the woods, I promise.
Okay.
So there is that definition of it. But to me, I'm interpreting it as like I'm adding skills to my tool belt in order to get by, to sort of survive.
I'm a survivor. I'm good.
Exactly.
Okay, that's your theme song.
Beyonce, eat your heart out. Yeah. So that's what I came up with. And like in theater school and stuff, the professors would always talk about like having a survival job.
Mm.
And being a server is like a survival job.
Yep.
Or a temp job or babysitting, which I did. And so it's like something that pays the bills. And like, I think I've expanded on that. So it's like, it is somewhat of a passion for some of these things that I do, but it's not exactly what I would like to be doing if I had my choice of like how I was making a living. But yeah,
I like that.
That is my long-winded answer.
You know what? Like a good Renaissance person, we do really good long-winded answers, which is why it's rapidish fire questions at the end, and they're never rapid.
No.
But so when I texted you about coming on and you're like, I'll come on, but I don't really think I'm like a Renaissance person, I started thinking.
Yeah.
The most recent podcast episode, which I don't know if you got a chance to listen to it.
I did.
Yes. So another person who pushed back on the idea of at least the term Renaissance person. Stephanie Casilla was noting the idea of like, you know, Renaissance person is in the traditional way. You got the Michelangelo. You have these people who are amazing professionals as artists and they're amazing professionals as scientists. And it's very kind of career focused.
Right.
And so I kind of morphed my mindset on it. And I see two separate things happening. I think there's an idea of a maybe Renaissance career path. So that'd be somebody like myself where, okay, TV meteorologist, executive director of an arboretum, presenter at a science museum, jumped around to all these different jobs in different industries. That's one thing. Then there is the Renaissance person interests and passions in a lot of different things, whether or not their career jumps around that much.
Sure.
I have some people who are in the Renaissance Readers Group who have worked at IBM their entire career. And so you'd say, okay, well, they've been scientists at IBM. They're not a Renaissance person. But in their free time, they embroider or they swim or they're a musician. And so they have these passions of things that they do outside. Then there's also the term I've been throwing out, which is the Renaissance mindset.
Sure.
And this is what I see more of with you.
Yeah.
Which is you are a person who is insanely curious. You're a person who will dive down a rabbit hole just because you're interested in the topic.
Right.
And learn all this sort of stuff. And you don't necessarily immediately have an application for that knowledge. You're just curious for the sake of curiosity. And then later on, you know, you destroy me when we're playing Trivial Pursuit because you've got all these facts on these random things. And I'm really bad at memorizing facts. And Brian and my husband are also very good. So you don't want me on the Trivial Pursuit team, but Brian is... He's a clutch. But I feel like that's where I see your Renaissance-ness in that you don't limit yourself to, say, only watching movies about artists or only reading articles about artists. You're interested in a wide range of topics.
Yeah.
And the other place where I see you kind of as a Renaissance person, something I talked about in a previous episode about the idea of growing up. And when we were kids, you and I were both very well-rounded.
Yes.
We were the kids who, by the time we graduated, we were in the advanced math. We were in advanced science. We were in advanced English. And we were doing well in all of those. And we were in band and theater and math team and all these different things.
Right.
So at that point in time, before you had necessarily like really honed in on a career and a desire to have a career in the arts some way, I felt more Renaissance-y. And even I always think about what you told me about the biology class at UMD.
Oh, yeah.
Do you want to share? Because I might get the facts wrong and then you don't have to correct me. What was the situation?
Okay. Well, yeah.
Now I'm embarrassing you.
No, I'm like,
oh, stop embarrassing
me. Oh my gosh. Is this just like, let's praise Brian's smartness for
yes
for this whole hour. Yeah, no. So it was like a liberal arts school and you had to do science with a lab and blah, blah, blah. So I decided I don't want to take the biology course that's for non-majors. I took some like accelerated biology in high school and I enjoyed it because like biology is a lot of memorization.
Yeah, my least favorite.
And as somebody who's an actor, I'm like, I can store all that information. Yeah, let's do it. Plus, I found it interesting, you know, with like Punnett squares and stuff and like figuring out eye color and whatever. So
that's my favorite part of biology, by the way.
Yeah, that is cool.
Because that's applied and not memorizing.
Yeah. And so I was like, you know what? I'm just going to take the biology for like freshman majors. And I was like a senior at this point, and I had sort of saved this till the end because I was just putting it off. And I was like, well, who knows? Maybe I'll remember a lot from sophomore year of high school. And I did.
Yep.
And like, you know, University of Minnesota Duluth is not necessarily known for being a super academically rigorous place for science. I'm not exactly sure what they're known for besides hockey.
Cold.
Yeah.
Hockey and cold.
Like maybe they have a good nursing program. I forget. But they had a good musical theater program.
Yes, they did.
So yeah, I ended up doing really well in the class and I, you know, I got over 100% or whatever with like extra credit. And at the end, the teacher sort of pulled me aside and asked if I was a science major. And I told her no, that I was a musical theater major. And she wanted to know if I would want to TA the class the next semester. But this was my second semester senior year. So I said no. But it was nice to know that, like, if I had tried to pursue science at UMD, I would have been, you know, just fine.
Yeah.
At least in that one class. So, yeah, I mean, like you were saying, I do agree that, like, while I don't necessarily consider myself a Renaissance person, I do think that I have a well-rounded skill set and mindset. Mm-hmm. And I think part of that was like, I mean, I'm sure some of that is just like genetic or whatever, but I think having you as an older sibling to model sort of like, you can be good at everything if you want to be, if you have the aptitude for it, like that set the bar pretty high, which was both daunting, but also freeing in a way that like, yeah. I didn't feel super self-conscious about like being interested in a wide variety of things when some other kids were sort of hyper-specializing, which I feel like maybe is more of a thing nowadays of hyper-specializing than it was when we were kids. But yeah, and I do like just learning new things. And I think that's why I've been drawn to trivia.
Yep.
Because like, and that's not necessarily even like a, oh, I like this, I'm going to commit this to memory. I just can't help but commit that to memory. Like to learn something and be like, that's weird. Like, I'm definitely going to remember that. But yeah, trivia is also a lot of memorization. So there you go. I guess like I just have a good mind for memory.
Really interesting. Yeah. And I think actually your career and your outside interests have taken you into spaces where that love of learning has really served you well.
Yeah.
So I know you've told me when you were looking at going to college, I'm 2 years ahead. I already picked journalism. So you had decided that was not an option for you because you can't copy your sister.
Not that I was ever really interested in journalism, but yeah, like the fact that you were so good at so many things and like could have gone into any number of things. I feel like both of us probably could have gone into any number of things and been pretty successful if we were passionate about it.
Yeah.
But for me, like, I don't know. Once I discovered like theater and that was something that I was actually good at and maybe better than you at.
Definitely.
I was maybe I found it. And like
I got my thing.
Yeah, exactly. Because I was like, I don't want to live in Sarah's shadow. But it wasn't even that. My decision to go into it was not like, because Sarah's not doing this, I'm going to do it. I just like, when we were in that children's theater production of Cinderella when I was in second grade, and like, I figured out that I could sort of turn something that was an insecurity into something that made people laugh, which is because I was cast as this really nerdy character. And I was a dork as a kid, and I still am. I was so nervous that the other kids were gonna laugh at me in like a make fun of me sort of way.
Yeah.
But then when I was able to like, oh, I'm entertaining these people, they're laughing with me in a way.
And you have control over the
yes,
laughter.
Exactly.
I'm making it happen.
I was like, ooh, oh, okay. And then combine that with music and dance and stuff, like,
yeah,
sign me up. Ever since I discovered that, I was just like, no, I'm gonna be an actor when I grow up. And like, I don't care, like, I like these other things. I can do these other things in school. But like, yeah, like being an actor was sort of just end game for me. And I just knew that from an early age. And I don't know, like, how old were you when you legitimately thought, oh, I could have a career in broadcasting or news?
That was from when I was in 10th grade.
Okay.
When I did the youth and government program.
Right. Yeah.
And I was part of the TV station. And before that, in middle school, I had wanted to do special effects and sound effects for TV and movies.
What?
Yes. And I could tell you exactly why. So our mom, Mary, is a piano teacher.
Yeah.
And one of her students' uncles does that as a career. And he needed somebody to play this rickety old-time piano. So mom went over to this house that had a rickety old-time piano. She played for them. They recorded it. And then she got to watch them. Like, the thing I remember the most is she told me that they jumped up in the air and, like, slammed their bodies onto the wood and recorded the sound of that because they needed a sound of like somebody falling.
Yeah.
And I was like, that sounds great. Sign me up. Oh, that's my career.
Yes.
That was, I think, seventh grade and or sixth or seventh. And then there was the job shadow day. Do you remember where you got to go and follow somebody around while they did their job? And so I asked mom, can I go with your piano student's uncle? And he said yes. And so I actually got to go into the studio. I got to record my own voice and have it put as a voiceover for a commercial for the Minnesota State Lottery. And they recorded it on VHS for me.
Oh, wow.
So I could bring it
Fancy.
Home. I think mom and dad have the VHS still.
Probably.
It's in that collection.
If it hasn't been like recorded over by me.
Yeah.
Recording like the Survivor finale or something from 2003.
For all we know. But yeah, I saw that and I was like, ooh, it was great. It was theatrical.
Yeah.
There was a microphone involved. There was an audience, even though I couldn't see them. And so that kind of got me thinking slightly differently. And because before that, I wanted to be an actress on the stage. I love the applause. I love the theater. We grew up in the theater. Our dad was in shows. So even before you and I were ever in a show, we were going to the church to see dad in a musical.
Yeah.
And so it was very much a thing that was very doable. And then you have mom with a piano background that it was just like, okay, you know, the theater, the musical theater world is a world we very much so knew.
We knew it.
But this expanded it.
Yeah. But was it something that we could make a living doing? There wasn't that necessarily.
No.
For us to see, but like we knew that we could at least do it for fun. And yeah.
And that you could have a career in music.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly.
So we saw a piano teacher. So I think we had maybe that little broader perspective of the arts is something as a viable job for people.
Well, and like not to steer it in sort of a different direction, but like
we go in all directions on this show, Brian.
Okay. Fine.
Take the lead. I will follow.
Let's do this thing. Let's do an about face. We're going
U-turn.
A different direction. Well, so our dad, Gary, had a variety of different jobs when we were kids. And I think he had had his job, his main job up until I was maybe third or fourth grade. And then it was like a series of sort of every couple of years, maybe he would get laid off and have to find a new job. And it was mostly in the same field. I think seeing his like resilience and his positive attitude and just like being able to get up and do these interviews or do temp work, hoping that it would become permanent or things like that. I think that actually gave me the confidence to pursue something that lacks job security, like the performing arts, because I was like, oh, if he can do that and like still support a family of four. And like we have a house, like we never, you know, like, yes, we pinched pennies a bit, a lot of Flavorite brand cereals and stuff, or Maltomeal in the big bags.
Oh, yum.
And we are like a very frugal family. So like we know how to how to save a buck. But I think seeing that really was like eye opening for me that like, oh, like, yeah, you're going to have times where you don't know what you're doing next. And it's just like how you pick yourself up and move forward. And like, acting is most of the time a lack of job security because like unless you are in some sort of open-ended run on Broadway or some TV show that lasts forever, you know exactly when your job is going to end and you have to pick yourself up and go audition for the next thing. And sometimes you don't have anything coming up. You're really lucky if you have a bunch of things on your plate coming up and you can like at least track like the next like 6 months or even a year. But that's really rare for an actor.
And the fact that you're in insurance is tied to that.
Exactly.
And not even knowing for certain your insurance is going to continue, which we dealt with as kids with dad losing his job and insurance and COBRA and all of that. So
Yeah. It's a lot, but it made me a little more confident in pursuing it.
Yeah.
And I was confident to a degree, at least, or I wanted to be, about my skill level and like my ability to be a performer. And I was happy that it panned out and that I wasn't like completely wrong about
rejected.
about my skills. But like, obviously, it's one thing being an actor in the Twin Cities and then moving to New York and getting sort of like big for my britches. And then having that sort of like, oh, this is the next level, like not just in terms of the caliber of talent here, but like the sheer number of people who are also trying to be actors and the cost of living. So like having my survival jobs, like babysitting or writing articles and stuff, like that sort of became a lot. Like I had to do a lot more of that to like get by. And then it was too much to try to fit in auditions. And then suddenly, you know, I'm babysitting from like 8 a.m. until 6 p.m. or something. And then, well, there goes all the auditions for that day. So
yeah,
the people who are able to do that and do both things and still be able to pursue what they want to do is like hats off to them. So I'm really glad that I found improv, which is like, I'm not getting paid to do it, but it does fulfill that sort of creative need in me. Plus, like you said, all of my weird, like anything that you know or that you've learned, you can bring into improv. If you need to like name drop some like random, I don't know, president or something, like you have that in your toolbox. And I've definitely whipped out some weird trivia. And like, you know, you hear that one person laugh in the back who like gets what you just referenced. Mm-hmm. But everybody else is just like, whatever, that was weird. So I do love that aspect of improv.
That's what I was going to bring up, was I think that you being involved in improv, I think improv is a space where Renaissance people can really thrive because of the wealth of experience that they can draw from. And they have interest in these other areas. Like I went and saw one of your shows. Mm-hmm. And it ended up going in the direction of Watergate. And most of the people on stage were familiar with Watergate, Deep Throat, all these jokes. And then there was one person who you could kind of tell as an audience member who knew about Watergate that they maybe didn't get it quite as much. It was still hilarious because their not knowing it added another layer of funniness to it.
Yeah.
But as somebody who knew about it, just because I'm old, but I also know about stuff, it made the jokes even funnier and the laughs even deeper. And it's almost like you as the person on stage who's going super deep into this historical time period and this specific event, like you're almost winking at us in the audience being like, yeah, I'm going there. Right. You know what I'm doing.
Exactly.
And it's really fun.
Well, and like the core tenet of improv is like, yes, and basically what that means is if somebody says something on stage, you treat it as truth and then you add on to it, you embellish on it. And so, yeah, in something like that, where you might have a wide range of knowledge about a certain topic, if somebody who knows nothing about that topic says something, you're like, yeah, that is true. Like Martha Washington, I don't know, like did date an oak tree at 15 or something. Like, I don't know, it's just some random, you're like, yeah, okay, we're spouting all these facts.
I'm going with you.
And then somebody comes in with like something that's completely out of left field and we're like, yep, that happened. But also the tree proposed to her and she turned it down because she met George. You find ways to tie it all back in. That is an aspect of improv that I do really love because it forces you to stay on your toes and accept a truth that somebody else brings to the table. And I think improv has a lot of good applications outside of just being entertaining, because like improv theaters do workshops and stuff for businesses. And it's a great tool to just learn how to yes and somebody else's idea that might be completely different than what you had in mind, and like finding a way to marry those two things or to not outwardly like reject somebody's idea.
Yeah.
If it doesn't fit your idea of like what they should be talking about. about, to really give people permission to like have their own thoughts and like mm-hmm. find a way to marry them and to also think outside the box. Another core thing for improv is A to C-ing or even A to Z-ing things. Like if you get a suggestion of like box or something, well, you know, think outside the box. But why did I think of the word box?
Whoa, where did that come from?
Instead of being like, okay, now I'm going to do a scene or a show about a box. A to C means like, okay, well, what does the word box make you think of? Well, maybe it makes you think of a cardboard box, but maybe that makes you think of a delivery or like Amazon or something. And so you get box, but then you do a show about like a delivery person. Or maybe it makes you think a TV is sometimes referred to as a box. And so maybe you do a show about people who live inside a TV or something.
Or you go to Schrödinger's cat.
Exactly.
That's where my brain goes. Mm. Is it alive? Is it dead? Is it both things at once?
Right.
Ooh, that's deep. Science.
A box can be so many things. So yeah, there's just such a freedom about it because you can go literal, but you can also go outside the box a little
bit. Well, outside the box and improv are both ideas that have come up frequently on my show.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing with improvisation is that any time you're doing improvisation, whether you're doing it on a stage, whether you're doing it as you're having a job interview mm-hmm. and you're having to answer the questions,
exactly,
whether you have a team meeting and you're brainstorming what your idea is or how you're going to solve a problem, the fact that you are a Renaissance person and have ideas and experiences from outside of whatever that setting is that you're in, you are more likely to be able to think outside the box.
Yeah.
Because you know what's outside the box.
Yeah.
Versus those people who get the company job and they stay there and they hyper specialize and they study deeper and deeper and deeper and more and more and more. If you have those other experiences, you're a better improv partner
mm-hmm.
because you can bring in other things.
Exactly. Yeah. You're not so hyper specialized. And not that there's anything wrong with that if it serves you well. But I mean, when we talk about like athletes, like being a multi-sport athlete is so often advantageous. I think of like Dana Retke, who is a middle blocker in women's volleyball now for Team USA, but she used to play at the University of Wisconsin. And, you know, she's like 6'7" or something. And she used to be a dancer. And it's like, okay, cool. And now she plays volleyball. But like you think of the footwork in volleyball, especially moving laterally and moving back to like go hit a ball and then you have to
transition,
move side to side to like block people. And then, yeah, it's all about the transition and the footwork. Having somebody who is light on their feet at that height is such a strength for a team. And so, of course, she excels. You hear about all these top athletes who like, oh, yeah, they played soccer and basketball and volleyball and ran track.
Yeah. Tiger Woods is the exception to the rule. Like Tiger Woods sure. and the whole like trained at 3 years old to be amazing golfer.
Mm-hmm.
At the very beginning, you were talking about how you and I grew up and the idea of being well-rounded, I think, was more embraced.
Yeah.
And now there's more this focus. You got to specialize your child now because if they aren't excellent at that sport by 9, they're never going to make it to the Olympics. Versus when they do research and look at these professional athletes
right.
who are doing really well, most of them did not specialize until much, much later in life and having
right.
all those different sports and training their muscles differently.
Yeah.
And treating their cardiovascular system differently. All that variety is what makes them, one, better all around when they do pick something. And also, two, it gives them time to figure out what they want to specialize in.
Exactly.
Versus if a parent decides you're going to do this. And same thing, top musicians a lot of times have played multiple different instruments before they pick the one. And Dr. Suzuki, the mm-hmm. Suzuki method that our mom teaches, violin is what he wrote the Suzuki method based on, and it got expanded to piano and other areas. But
yeah.
he didn't specialize in violin until much later in life.
Right.
And the stories I am sharing are actually from something I'm going to throw in the show notes.
Oh.
Grab your drink.
I'm going to drink my water.
Take a drink.
Hey.
Mine too. Delicious. For those who have not listened before, one of my little running jokes is take a drink with the show notes because I love putting resources into the show notes that can help people out because that's what we Renaissance people do is we find things and we like to share it with other people.
Yeah.
But these are from the book Range, Why Generalists Thrive in a Specialized World by David Epstein, which is what the Renaissance Reader Book Club is reading, which Dad is a member of that book club. So he actually has.
Oh, of course.
Of course, because he's a Renaissance man. course.
That's right.
So anyways, yeah, well, beyond your work in improv, I feel like improv is a place where specifically your, I'm not going to go in your survivalist stuff because I think that's a little more skill specific, but
sure.
Your Renaissance person love of learning has been accepted, embraced, and it's helped you excel in the realm of improv. Where else would you say that having that Renaissance mindset of being that lifelong learner has helped you be really successful, either in a career setting or some other type of setting?
Well, I mean, I think you can't help but bring all of your skills to any job that you have. When I was babysitting, for example, I have a wide variety of things that I enjoy or am good at. And so like homework help, clutch, you know, like maybe I don't know about this newfangled math because I learned it differently, but I'm willing to learn.
Yes.
And so much of that feeds into my creativity, even like the more scientific mathematical things. I mean, STEAM, you know, it's all connected, I guess. So telling stories or being able to play pretend with kids and be able to bring all of those things into it, I think made me a more valuable babysitter and more entertaining for them. But then also, like, my current job is in social media, and specifically sort of in the news. And yes, we have a sort of specific audience that we are targeting. Being well-versed in like a wide variety of topics, I think, has been helpful because we'll have so many political articles or entertainment articles, and knowing both of those realms, but then also be able to like talk about the Olympics, for example, and sort of know what I'm talking about and not just like sort of regurgitating and have no idea. I think that's helpful because as like an editor, I can sort of help guide the writers and answer questions about like, what does this mean? And so I think I've used it in pretty much all of my jobs and even as an actor too. You're bringing yourself as an actor to any role that you play. And the more things that you are able to do or the more tools in your tool belt, the more castable I think you are. And then every time you play a role where maybe it's something that you haven't encountered before, now you're learning something new. Like, just because maybe you play Betsy Ross doesn't mean that you're like suddenly the most amazing seamstress, but maybe as part of the process of rehearsal, you have to like learn how to do a basic cross stitch or something to make it look believable on stage, or learn about different fabrics.
Yeah, it makes me think of when you were in the show Vestibular Sense. Do you want to talk about how for that particular show, you actually ended up doing quite a bit of research on the topic and as it related to your character?
Yeah. So the character that I was playing was a 19-year-old autistic boy, and he worked at like a Norse theme park. And so I learned a bunch about Norse mythology, but also as a cast, we went and visited a place called the Fraser Center, which is like a big center for people with autism. And we observed people that were higher on the spectrum. And I know that the language around autism spectrum disorders has sort of changed.
Yeah.
But we saw the full spectrum while we were there, just to get a sense of like how it manifests itself physically or verbally, just because you want to be able to portray something like that as authentically as you can. And like, mm-hmm. I had encountered kids with autism when we were teaching summer school or things like that. So I had a general idea of how it might manifest itself. And obviously that got me the job because we didn't really dive deeply into it until we were into the rehearsal process. So I was already cast. But yeah, just being able to see that and talk to people and get feedback about like, actually, no, you probably wouldn't do that. Or who knows? I mean, it can manifest itself in any different way. So maybe there is no like wrong answer or mm-hmm. wrong way to do it. That was an exhausting show because there was a lot of memorization. It was a lot of like sort of rambling monologues about Norse mythology and roller coasters and things like that. But it was a lot of moving around and stimming. And at one point I had a big meltdown and I had to sort of like figure out a way to make it look like I was slamming my head against the stage. And then like also there was this like sack that I would sit in and get spun around in. And like my vestibular sense is fine, which your vestibular sense is your relation to gravity, basically. basically. Mm-hmm. And so for autistic people, like, it's maybe a little less honed in. And so there's this sort of therapy sack that you can sit in and spin it around, and that you really feel the gravity.
That was just hanging from the ceiling, right?
Yeah, yeah. And it's like sort of like a stretchy fabric, whatever. It really like encases
you. It cocoons you almost.
Yes, it cocoons you. I had to figure out, like, because they were spinning me around and spinning them around. We were practicing the different scenes for like so long. And I was like, okay, you have to like spin me the other direction to undizzy me, because I'm going to throw up.
I don't want to throw up.
Yeah. So I like had to take Dramamine. But yeah, it was a lot. But like, I feel like I learned a lot from that experience. And I really enjoyed that as an actor. Like, I feel like that's like sort of a dream thing to do if you're somebody who likes a challenge. And I do really enjoy a challenge like that. So yeah, I think my interest in that really helped me be able to deliver a more believable performance. Because like, if I had sort of just phoned it in, or thought like, you know, I kind of feel like I know everything I need to know to like get by with this part.
I've seen Rain Man. I'm good
to go.
Yeah,
exactly. Like, I don't think it would have been as impactful or believable. So
yeah, I love that. Kind of going on a slightly different direction, but I think it still aligns. One of the things that I hear you saying a lot is about your toolkit.
Yeah, that's my metaphor.
And how you have this skill. That's your metaphor. You know what? I call it yours.
Dang it. I know she's going to ask
this
question.
I talk about it. No. It's all good. I have my very first newsletter that I started, which is for job seekers, is called Take It With You. And I use the metaphor of travel and a multi-destination trip when talking about your career, going back to dad, all the different positions and everything. Okay. And the metaphor that I use is I talk about packing your skill set suitcase. And they're like, every place you stop at, you might add new tools into your skill set suitcase. You might stop in one place and learn a foreign language. You learn to physically speak the language of autism.
Yeah.
You know, you have all these things. And the metaphor of travel, I think, works really well for careers, and especially for people who are moving a lot in their career into different things.
Yeah.
Would you say that when you think about the skills that you take with you, is that a place where you feel like maybe you're connecting the dots and saying, hey, here's this one idea here, and then here's where it applies over there? Or are there other places where you say you connect the dots?
I mean, I definitely think that is one place where I connect the dots. And in terms of what does connecting the dots even mean when you're talking about like the arts, I would say that, well, I don't know, maybe this isn't true, but I think it is. The majority of the artists that you meet are really empathic people. And I think acting is something that sort of requires that. If you really want to do well at it, you have to really dive in and get to know who this character is. Even if it's like you're playing some cartoony villain, to try to find maybe the humanity in them, or why that they're doing the things that they're doing. And I think that is sort of connecting the dots in a sort of human way, trying to connect to other people. Because the more that you do, the more different kinds of people that you interact with or see on stage, the more you're likely to empathize with people that are different than you. And so I think that is one way of connecting the dots. But just like bringing all of your skills to something and figuring out, oh, this is a completely unrelated thing, but I feel like it's useful in this application. I'm trying to think of like a specific example. Like, you can have pretty different jobs and be able to bring something from a job that you don't think is going to be useful in the new job. And then suddenly it's like, oh, actually, I can apply this right here. And so that's connecting dots, I think, in a way as well.
I would definitely say that people who go into any field that has a big focus on communication in general, whether you're a journalist, whether you're a teacher, whether you're an actor or writing articles, I think you have to naturally be a dot connector and have that level of empathy. And I think both you and I have been drawn to careers that are about communicating knowledge, communicating emotions, communicating things to other people, and and having them hear and understand and potentially empathize.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, and I would say probably anybody who really considers themselves a Renaissance person has that mindset of wanting to learn about other people and other skills skills and cultures and things like that. I think that's just the type of person that is drawn to be a Renaissance person, and maybe vice versa.
Do you think you're drawn to Renaissance people? I feel like you have a lot of friends who are.
Yeah. I am drawn to people who are just interested in a lot of different things and are very multifaceted people.
Why?
Well, because I think we're drawn to people that are like ourselves a bit.
Wait, are you saying that maybe my idea that you're a Renaissance man might have some validity?
Well, maybe I wouldn't say that word, but like...
Yes, pick your own identity.
Yeah, but like...
Venn diagram.
Exactly.
Somebody I was talking with earlier today, she came up with a term that I just like immediately was like, that's perfect. We are knowledge magpies.
Like the birds?
Okay. Like the birds who collect all the shiny objects and like hide them in their little nests.
I mean, like magpies, crows, they're all very smart, those birds.
Yeah. And they collect all the shiny, sparkly, thoughtful things and just like, oh, knowledge, I'll collect that one and that one and store it in here.
Yeah. But more than just like somebody who's smart, for example, like, yes, of course, I love talking with somebody who's smart. But if that's their entire personality, sort of,
yes.
I get bored. Who is passionate about something that maybe is different than what they do for work, doesn't have to be, but be passionate about something, and who's just like really tuned in to the world, like politics and entertainment and things. You don't have to know everything. You don't have to be constantly reading the news or something, but I'm just drawn to people that care about things. And I think that's a lot of people, but like...
There's caring and empathy again.
In New York, you meet a lot of those kinds of people because New York tends to attract people who have that mindset. I'm sure I've met like boring people in New York, but there's just a lot of interesting people and there's a lot of interesting people in the arts. So yeah, I'm drawn to them.
You're in New York City. I'm an hour and a half north of you. I think New York City in particular attracts people. I've lived in 6 different states, and I tend to get closest to the people who have not spent their entire life living in the place that we moved to. I friend people who are...
Transplants, yeah.
I jokingly like to call us the expats. And I think because they were willing to uproot themselves and leave their home to go to another place that's unknown, and especially the ones who don't...
It's risky.
...have like a ton of friends.
They're risk takers, yeah.
They're not moving somewhere because they've got all their family. And I also think that those are oftentimes some of the people who are at the greatest risk for loneliness. And with our loneliness epidemic going on right now, you know, maybe it didn't happen in the past because not that many people left the small town they grew up in. But those of us who have done that, we see the value of all these experiences we've had. We know how to make friends. We know how to network and all that sort of stuff. But every time you do move, it is a little bit like starting over. And you are having to build your own friend group. And as adults, we don't find friends as easily as children do, and even young adults, because they've got that built in. Like school, we will sit together for hours and just have things to talk about because we're all going through the same thing. Versus you just make adult friends when you move. And it's like, initially, our adult friends here were parents of kids, same age as my children. But I'm like, okay, I can only have so many mom friends. And now I've kind of like winnowed down the mom friends and I've stayed close with the ones who are more Renaissance people-y.
Yeah.
So friends from New York who are listening, you made it. You made the cut. And then the other ones, I'm like, oh, well, yeah, we'll stand and talk about what the kids are up to lately. But if that's the only conversation we can have, okay.
Yeah.
They'll have that conversation. Let's move on.
That's a good segue to actually talk about the theme song for Connecting the Dots. Because like we promised we'd talk about that. And now we're like 52 minutes into it.
This is what happened when we chat.
Like, I'm trying to remember exactly what the prompt sort of what you were looking for when you approached me. But so for those who don't know, one of my other sort of interests is creating a cappella renditions of songs using GarageBand, which is a program on Mac.
And we'll put it in the show note. We'll put links to all sorts of great songs Brian has recorded and that are available
on YouTube. Just like link to my YouTube channel, which is like pretty sparse, but there are some options on there for you to watch.
Your nieces love it.
Okay, good.
They're like, what? Brian's famous? Are we famous too because we're related to him? I'm like, absolutely, girls. Yep.
I mean, if like 300 views of a video makes you famous, then hey.
Yep.
I'm Julia Roberts, I guess.
Totally.
But I knew that I wanted to bring that sort of style of music or recording to this, and I think you wanted that as well. But it's not completely a cappella because there is like that marimba sort of underneath, which, so I don't know what I started with. I think I sort of like had an idea.
Yeah, and I gave you some to listen to.
Yeah.
One in particular that I really love, get ready, show notes, drink, is Allie Ward's Ologies. Mm-hmm. And what I love about it is that it's like meteorology, visitology, blah, blah, blahology, blah, blah, blah. And they just like list off all these different ologies.
Yeah.
And it's kind of fun and it's got a rhythm to it. And I'm like, oh, I kind of like the vibe of this.
Yeah.
This is one thing.
Yeah.
And then we have the glissando.
Oh, right.
Which was something that was important
yes.
to me.
Yes. You wanted the glissando. You pushed hard for the glissando. And I do think it works.
It works. And for those who don't know it, a glissando is like if you're playing the piano and say you put your fingers down on one note and then you swiped your fingers up, it would play all of the white keys. So it'd be like that you'll hear at the very beginning, and I'll put it in right here. Ready? Okay, that was the glissando.
Just like that.
Just like okay. that. The magic of editing. But the reason I wanted a glissando is because if you wrote out the actual music, it would be dots that are connected.
Mm-hmm. So
it was like a secret thing, the Easter egg
yeah.
for the musicians in the group
yeah.
to know it's dots that are connected.
And I think I also knew that I kind of just wanted any lyrics to just be the title of the yeah. podcast, but I also kind of didn't want it all to sound the same. I think going off of your ologies thing, I didn't want it to sound so crazy, cacophonous that it was like hard to decipher, because I don't know if that's exactly what you're going for with connecting the dots. That's just like putting a whole bunch of dots out there.
Yeah, we talk about how hard it is to explain our complex self in a simplified
yeah.
manner.
Yeah.
It's hard to narrow things down and simplify. So I'm glad you got to have people in your life like my brother who are like, Sarah, a little too much.
Yeah.
Let's edit. Cut a few things out.
I did really like that marimba sound. I've heard it in other podcasts and it just has this sort of thoughtfulness to it. It has that like the overtone. So like you can kind of mishear it and think it sounds weird. But then if you like put your headphones in or turn up the volume, you're like, oh, it's like doing this weird fifth over the top of like what the actual note is. So whatever, I just think it's a really interesting sort of calm but thoughtful sound.
I wonder what it is about the marimba, about that piece of wood that you strike that makes it
yeah, the
play
resonance.
Two notes at the same time.
I don't know, something about the hollowness of it. I'm curious as well. I guess that's our next rabbit hole.
There we go.
I knew that I kind of wanted the two sections of connecting the dots and with the Renaissance people to sound a little different.
Mm-hmm.
And so the connecting the dots is like auto-tuned to the extreme to almost sound a little robotic, because I think with the stem of it all, it's very sciencey, very robotic-y in my mind. And if you notice, there's a little pause between each syllable of connecting the dots, because like if I made it too sort of legato or smooth and it was just connecting the dots, it wouldn't feel dotty in my mind. When I think of a dot, I think of quick punch, staccato in music. And then also, I'm connecting the dots, but with each syllable, I'm adding a new harmony to that to make it more complex. So I'm connecting the dots between the notes and between the syllables of the words, connecting the dots. And then
loving this.
Once we get into with the Renaissance people, that's when I just sort of, we've connected the dots, now let's let loose with our tribe, sort of, you know?
Yes.
And so that part is in full harmony. Plus, I wouldn't necessarily say before that it's in a minor key or anything. It's sort of in like a nebulous key. But then mm-hmm. once we get to with the Renaissance people, it shifts into this major chord, which
yes.
in my mind, when you do that, when you resolve into a major chord, there's like sort of a relief, there's a happiness about it.
It makes me think of church.
Yeah.
And the organ hits that and it's like, yes.
Yeah, where it's like, you know, like I just love when a chord resolves like that. But then after I recorded it, I realized it's a very similar, not necessarily the melody, but like the chord structure is very similar to, are you ready for some football, you know, which like that is an exciting opening to football. Like you're getting people
yeah.
ready for kind of a party and to be entertained and to celebrate. And I think a lot of that is having that major chord sort of resolve with football.
And a lot of Renaissance people teach workout classes
yeah.
or are athletes.
Oh, yeah.
Like that has been a reoccurring theme with so many of the people that I talk to. So inadvertent connection.
Right.
Serendipity.
But then, yeah.
I love love it.
It's less auto-tuned to just sound more like my normal singing voice, because now the people are joined, you know, they've been connected. So yeah, that was sort of my thought process going into it. And then we added the glissando, because I do think it has a nice punch to like end now we're starting, or when you do it at the end going down now it's done.
Yep. So if you listen, you'll hear it goes up at the beginning, and then at the very end it's the glissando down, but the same set of notes, the same octave.
Yeah,
from C to C.
Exactly. So yeah, that's my thought process there.
So much fun. I love it. And there's things that you told me that I didn't even realize. So that's fun. And I actually, you know what? I'm going to do our game really quickly.
Okay.
And I will say what I was going to say in the instance of the game. So we're going to play the complete the sentence.
Okay.
You know you're a Renaissance person if, and you've heard other episodes, you're a super fan.
Yeah.
So I'm going to give you two different ones that I've never said before,
okay,
and you get to improvise two of your own. And we're going to go with that expansive definition of Renaissance person, the lifelong learner. Your version of it is totally fine.
Okay.
So you know you are a Renaissance person if you have a lot of friends who come from different generations. Because I remember as a kid, I was the weirdo who would like talk to my friends' parents.
Yeah.
And then when I was in college, I was friends with my TAs, but I was also friends with my instructors, faculty members. I'm like, you're really interesting. You know more than me. You're older than me. That's fine. And even throughout my life, I've moved all around. I've made lots of friends who are older than me. And now I'm making quite a few friends who are in their 20s. And I see value in the youth. I see value in the age. I just find interesting people. If you're interesting, I don't care what age you are. I'll be your friend.
Yeah. Well, my sort of like jokey answer is, you know, you're a Renaissance person if you were a human who was born during the Renaissance period. But
that's
cheating. That's cheating. let's see. So I think one sort of based off of what we've been talking about is, you know, you're a Renaissance person if you can get excited talking about any subject.
Yeah.
Because like, if you're fascinated, like,
let's go.
Let's talk about anything. Like, if you're passionate about it, I'll be excited about it, and vice versa. Hopefully.
Hopefully. Excellent. Now I've forgotten the one that I was going to say.
Uh-oh. Oh, maybe let's just stick with one, because I don't know if
okay,
I have
we'll
another
one. We'll stick
with
one because we're going a long time. Improv boy, what? You can't improvise? That's okay. I'm going to forgive you this time. So we're going to do the rapidish fire questions, and maybe they will be actually rapid. What is one metaphor you find yourself using frequently?
Well, I already said it. Tools in my toolkit.
Woo-hoo!
Or tool belt. You know, it's a big belt.
It's like Batman.
Yeah, it can weigh your pants down. You just got to make sure it's like really secured well to your waist.
Otherwise,
you might
X-rated show.
You might moon some people, and you don't want to show your whole butt.
No, don't want to do that.
No.
Yeah, this is why this is an explicit podcast.
That's right. I said
like
the B
that.
Word, but
and I'm pretty certain your nieces think that
you
is.
Can't let my nieces listen. Yeah.
How about then, what's one rabbit hole that you have gone down recently?
Ugh, that's so hard because everything I look up, I go down a rabbit hole, I think. I'm trying to think of anything specific because like with my job, all I'm doing is like looking up news and going on social media all day. And so you could probably say anything and I'd be like, yeah, I've gone down a rabbit hole on that. I think one of my most common rabbit holes though is watching a TV or a movie and seeing somebody either that I recognize but I can't place where else I've seen them, or somebody who I know I don't know, but then I want to see what else they've been in. And I'll go to like IMDb and I'll look up like the thing that I'm watching and find that person. And then I start looking at everything that they've been in and I'm like, oh my gosh, they were in this? Oh yeah, I remember that. And they're like, Meryl Streep was in that? What else is, like how many Oscars has Meryl Streep been nominated for? You know, like I will just go down this rabbit hole and then like, it'll be an hour later and I'm somehow like looking at like the cast of Barney and Friends. And I'm like, how did I get here? Just because I was connecting those dots, baby.
Yeah. And when people ask, what did we do before IMDb?
Yeah.
And I can tell you.
That's right.
There were two giant books at the video rental store that we worked at that had been a Blockbuster and then was sold and was just an independent store. And one of the books had like the names of all the movies.
Yeah.
And then I think the one had all the
actors.
People who were in them. Yeah, all the actors.
So it was one was by actor, one was by title of movie.
Yeah. And so we were like librarians because somebody would come in and they're like, okay, so I want that movie that had that guy in it who was in that other movie. And if we could get to a point where they could name either an actor or a movie title.
Yeah.
Then we would jump to one of the two books, cross-check, jump to the other book.
Like, yeah, because I think
we could figure it out.
I think the one that was by movie title would list at least the main cast members and like a brief synopsis of what the film was about. So
we got pretty good at that.
Yeah.
I remember people be like, wow. You can find that?
But it's like once you, like, because we worked at that movie store for several years. Once you've put movies away enough times, you start just remembering what the movie box looks like. And you know, you can you know exactly where it is. Even if you've never seen that movie, you're like, oh, I know exactly what you're talking about. That's over in comedy.
And we also got, we got to rent the movies for free.
Yes.
The new releases, you could only do it overnight. At the end of your shift, you took it home and you had to return it in the slot before they opened the next day. But the old movies you could take home and just watch. And I did the top 100.
Oh, yeah, you did AFI's like top 100.
AFI's top 100. We didn't have all of them. I had to go to like libraries and sleuth my way through it, but I found all of them.
Some of those older ones, yeah.
Yeah, I got a good baseline from that.
But like working at a movie store is like, was a thing.
Surprisingly good.
That was a great thing for a Renaissance person, I think, because you get all kinds of variety of subject matter, you know?
Yeah.
Great.
Okay. Here you get to throw in, and I have an idea of what you might answer this as, but you can pick your own thing.
Okay.
What is a job that you've had that might surprise people?
Oh, I feel like I've had so few jobs in my life because I think we've named all of them. Well, yeah. So like, no, I don't think anything that I've done would surprise anybody, honestly.
I have one.
Okay.
This goes with your survivalist title.
Okay, great.
Remember when you were saving up money to go to Europe?
Oh, yeah.
And you got that job making photocopies in like a completely windowless room.
Oh.
It was medicals.
Yeah. So that was my first job out of college. It was like at a time where hospitals and medical centers were like transitioning from paper charts and files to an online sort of database. And so I flew out to Freehold, New Jersey in like May, right after I graduated. And it was like with two other people who I'd gone to theater school with. And we would work really random hours. Like we would be like, oh, we're going to work from like 4 p.m. to like 4 a.m. this night. And it was like scanning these paper files into the system, QCing them, quality control, to make sure that they actually scanned in properly, and then classifying them into the correct place. It was just tedious work. We would all listen to like music or whatever while we were doing it. There was like no windows. We would just be in this like room that was filled with boxes of files. It was a little insane. I guess the other job that I sort of had that was random, I don't know if people would be like, oh, I'm surprised that you did that, was I read an American history textbook aloud to this sophomore in high school on the Upper West Side because he got a concussion playing rugby. And so it made him dizzy to like actually read his textbook. And so I would go over to his apartment and we'd sit at a table, or like I'd sit in a chair and he'd lay on his bed and I would just read his American history textbook, which of all the subjects, I think, like besides like English or something, like that one actually worked pretty well to do it that way, because American history is like
stories.
It's a story. Yeah, it's basically stories. And then he tried to have me do that with chemistry. And that did not work out so well, because I'm like, CH, 2, like little 2, big O, like, I don't know. I'm like, what are we doing here? This is like, that's like reading math, basically. So
yes,
he was like, yeah, let's not do that. Let's just have you keep reading American history and I'll do the biology and chemistry stuff on my own. I'm like, yeah, that works.
It's so funny you mentioned that. So I facilitate a visual science communication seminar series for the class that I teach at the University of Arizona. And this semester, March 20th. We actually have a woman who is blind, a person who was her teacher, who is an engineer, and a person who works at Microsoft. And the three of them work together to make math accessible for people who are blind.
Okay.
Which is kind of
because like when you think about it, it is really, it is a visual thing to be able to like process it, but it doesn't have to be.
Yeah.
Interesting.
And so that's what the whole presentation is going to be about. I'll send you a link in case you want to join us for it.
Okay.
Or we'll have a recording. It should be interesting. Okay. Now we're getting long on time.
Yeah.
So last thing I want to do is give you a chance to give a shout out to how people can follow you on social media, how they can be stalkers and show up and see your performances in person if they're in New York City. No, you can share whatever you want.
Hold on. As like an actor, like so much of it is about social media now. I don't even know my handle. Okay, hold on. So I don't post much on Instagram, but if you want to follow me there, my handle is B Skellinger, or you can just search for Brian Skellinger. There is another Brian Skellinger in the world in the United States, but he's a locksmith. So I'm not that.
In California, right?
No, Florida.
Oh, Florida.
Even worse.
I knew it was a warm state.
So don't friend him, friend me, or follow me. I think my page is public now. So otherwise, I'm also on YouTube if you look for Brian Skellinger. And you can find my acapella videos there. If you're ever in New York, assuming I'm still doing it, I do musical improv on Thursday nights at the Magnet Theater, which is on 29th Street and 8th Avenue, basically. And that's every Thursday. And it's really fun. So if you're ever in New York City, want to do something creative and stupid and silly, come see musical improv.
It's so much fun. They literally make up a musical in front of your eyes that's like, well, usually like 30 minutes long based on a suggestion from the audience.
Yeah.
And it is one of the best deals in terms of buying tickets for a live show in all of New York City.
Yeah. For this theater, it's 4 hours of musical improv. So it's two teams per hour, eight teams during the night. And you can get in for the whole night for $8. And you can stay for the whole entire night if you want. It's pretty nice.
And it's fairly close to a subway station. Mm-hmm. So you can walk there.
That's right.
From wherever you can travel around. So I've gone and seen multiple times. I'm planning on coming back again with mom and dad when they come to visit.
That's right.
We'll talk to you about the plans.
Okay. Yep.
Okay. I will talk to you later then, Brian. Thanks so much for coming on the show.
All righty. Thank you.
See ya.
Bye. Bye.
With the Renaissance people.